Hello, you are listening to an episode of Trade Talks, a podcast about the economics of trade policy. I am Sameha Keynes, the economics and trade correspondent for The Economist.
And I'm Chad Bown, a senior fellow with the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington. In this episode, we are going to talk to Dave Donaldson, professor of economics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. In 2017, Dave won the John Bates Clark Medal as that American economist under the age of 40 who is judged to have made the most significant contribution to economic thought and knowledge. We'll be talking to Dave about his award-winning research on the impact of railroads.
Often when we talk about things that ease trade, we think about trade deals. But the cost of moving things from A to B is a really, really important determinant of trade. And Dave's research looks into the impact of those trade costs on what's going on in the real world.
Dave, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for the chance to be here.
Okay, so the first paper we'll discuss is your one looking at the historical impact of railroads on the American economy. So could you just describe what happened in America over the 19th century?
The quick story is that around 1850, America started investing heavily in railroads. And this began in the Northeast, obviously, and quickly spread westwards and southwestwards. We look in particular at the real boom period of American railroad expansion, which was between about 1870 and 1890. This is really where the network west of the Appalachians just triples in density in the space of just a few decades. And people would go from being, 50, 100 kilometers, 200 kilometers from their nearest railroad line to an average rural resident being much closer, more like 10 or 20 kilometers.
So to start, can I ask, who was it that was building these railroads at the time?
This was all private investment in the case of the U.S. These are private companies that would sometimes get subsidies of various forms, often land grants, to build certain lines, but this was all private investment.
So as economists, in theory, what might the effect of that be?
Of course, there are a number of different effects that an economist would talk about here. The one that always interested me was trade. Basically, we would have these two or many regions of an economy that you're interested in, like the United States. In particular, we were looking at thousands of U.S. counties. And railroads, of course, the first order effect I think they would have had in an environment like this is just that they made it, as you said, cheaper to move goods from any given county to any other county, as long as those counties were affected by this new network. And of course, once trade flows are easier, then the sort of the effects of trade take over. You know, the people, regions can start to specialize. They can gain from those trades. Both the exporters and the importers of these goods in both directions, in general, we would think would gain from these trades. But of course, there are other effects. Maybe the most important other one would be human mobility. You know, that now passengers can travel, migrants can travel much easier. And that I don't want to suggest that is in any way less important. But the trade angle is the one I was most interested in studying.
So to be clear, the trade that we're talking about here is not foreign trade, international commerce. It's intra-regional trade within the United States. So why is it difficult to estimate the impact of railroads in a setting like this?
The way I think about it, there are two big issues. One is just that, like when you're estimating the impact of anything, there's a concern that that thing was sort of placed in your region of study at a time when that location would have changed anyway. It could have been a place that's declining, and that's why they got railroads as a sort of form of public investment, perhaps. It could have been a place that's booming, and that's why private investors wanted to get in as the boom was happening. And we just don't know which of those is the case in general. So I would say that that's sort of not, basically whenever you're evaluating something, you're comparing one location or one sub-economy to another. And we need to hope that sort of the reasons that one of these sub-economies got access to the program, in this case the railroads, was effectively as good as random vis-a-vis the outcomes of interest that you're studying, in our case something like growth. Just to be clear, the second obstacle I would see that makes a networked placement project like this potentially different is that when you have those two or many locations, it's not enough to just say that you believe that one of them randomly got access and the other one didn't, or as good as randomly. Because unfortunately, there's another problem, which is we call the spillovers problem, which is that the very act of the treatment group getting treatment, if you like that analogy, could affect the control group directly. And so the standard experimental design assumes that that doesn't happen. But in economic settings, and I think particularly in these sort of railroad network-like settings, that probably does happen.
So just for listeners not totally familiar with treatment and control, in this case, that the treatment is getting given a railroad, you want to compare that to someone that didn't get a railroad, the control, but you're worried that the people getting the railroad affected the people who didn't anyway, and so it's really hard to get the difference between those two.
That's exactly right. And in particular, you know, one would be worried about the possibility that the people who didn't get the railroads were positively affected by it. So just because they didn't get access doesn't mean they maybe couldn't have sort of enjoyed some of the benefits that would arise anyway. Their neighbors getting access means those neighbors are more productive. And if they buy something from those neighbors, that's a great thing. The neighbors get richer, they buy their goods, that's also a great thing. But unfortunately, it doesn't have to be a positive spillover. You could very much see negative spillovers, which would be where firms and investment and economic activity in general might flock to the places with the railroads and thereby leave the places without them. And that would be a negative spillover effect on the control group.
So how have economists tried to measure the impact of railroads in the past?
Well, by far the most important work on this has been done by the late economic historian Robert Fogel. He won a Nobel Prize largely for his work on the exact same U.S. railroads that we are looking at, the exact same period, 1870 to 1890. And he had this very clever insight that really goes back to some 19th century French engineers and economists. In these kinds of settings, there are plausible assumptions under which whenever somebody uses the thing you're studying, their benefit, and in fact you could argue that everybody, the social benefit, is given by their demand for that thing. And by that I mean their willingness to pay for the thing, you know, and captures not just their benefits, their willingness, but under some plausible assumptions, everybody's benefits, the full social benefits. So if that's the case, you can simply do what Fogel did, which is really just calculate two numbers. How much did the price of transport change when railroads rolled out and affected the transport economy? Of course, before railroads, alongside railroads, there were canals and oceanic routes and land trade as well. But so you need to figure out how much the railroads made the price of transport fall, and then you need to figure out how much more people started using that good, demanding that good, when that price fell. And if you just know those two numbers, the change in the price and the change in the quantity, you can form a very simple and very powerful estimate of those gains. The big difference here is that there's no control group when you do that. You're looking at the entire economy and you're assuming that everything that changed about the price was due to the railroads, and everything that changed about the quantity was also due to the new railroads.
Can you talk a little bit about your method and your approach to tackling this, I guess, then very old and interesting question?
Like as alluded to earlier, I was interested in the idea of trying to find a region or many regions that got access or were heavily affected by this and compare them to regions that were not or plausibly less affected by that. That's where a little bit of economic theory comes in to help. So trade economists use, and so do migration economists and capital flow economists, but they often find that in these settings of where something is flowing from bilaterally from one location to another location, that the so-called gravity model does very well. And you may have heard of that in the context of trade. It's a very well-fitting equation. So if you believe in that as a descriptive device for explaining who trades how much with whom, then that can, with a little bit of algebra, be used to motivate a particular expression for how, again, at any given point in time, how any given location, how much access they have, we call it market access, how much market access they have to all the other regions in the economy. And of course, what railroads would have done, or any transport innovation would have done, is improve a region's market access, or maybe improve most regions' market access. But the point is, the theory suggests that that's the right sort of metric to use for how much a place was affected, be it positively or negatively. And so at the end of the day, it comes down to finding, constructing that market access term properly and comparing regions that saw their market access go up a lot with regions that didn't see their market access change at all.
So the gravity model of trade is one that we use in a lot of different empirical contexts, but the basic story coming out of that model is two places trade more with each other the closer they are to each other geographically, and then the larger are their incomes.
you will trade a lot with people if you're sort of close to them. The only thing I would add is that you're close to them in a transport cost distance, not just physical distance. And of course, what the railroads did was to shrink that transport cost distance. And they did so more between certain pairs of locations than other pairs of locations, thanks to the shape of the network.
Okay, so that's the theoretical framework. How do you actually go about calculating these numbers? What's the kind of computation involved?
Well, the first ingredient is what we thought of, with a little bit of hubris, was sort of building something like a Google Maps for that late 19th century period. Google Maps app is, of course, behind the scenes, a model of the geography of the world. And by that we mean it's a networked model. So it tells you for any given point in space, there are things like roads that would allow you to travel to other points in space. And you know the kind of cost of travel in Google Maps, that's the speed, the amount of time it takes to go to travel along any of the segments on that network. So we tried to do something much, much, much more modest, of course, but we thought it was kind of the core essentials for this problem, which was to have a networked map of the transportation network in the late 19th century U.S. And we focused on, as I mentioned earlier, the canal network, the freshwater lakes and waterways travel networks, and the ocean routes, the land trade, not on railroads, and then finally the railroad network. And in our setup, it was the only thing that changed over that 1870 to 1890 period was the railroads, and the railroads network changed massively in this time period. So once you have that Google Maps network, a Google Maps-like network, you can ask it a question, like if I was at location A and I wanted to go to location B, what would be the cost or the time it would take to travel if I take the fastest route? So you need to be able to sort of calculate the fastest route, and of course Google Maps does that for you all the time. So all we had to do was just calculate for every county to every other county in the U.S., for every point in time, what was that cost of traveling along the cheapest route between that pair of counties? And that was the first ingredient that went into our calculation of market access.
And so that's the first indicator. Was there a second indicator that you looked at as well?
The second ingredient is to have an outcome variable that you care about, that you think is a proxy for economic success or performance or something, or welfare in a setting like this. There are a number of things we could have looked at. I mean, one could imagine looking at prices or wages or GDP of a given county at a given point in time. Unfortunately, the data on those things in the U.S. is in this time period is incredibly scarce. But there was one variable, one outcome that was available, tracked in the U.S. Census since about the mid-19th century, which was the value of land in the county. And that might seem a strange outcome to look at. Naively, you might think it's kind of a bad thing when the price of land goes up in the place where you reside. But there is a very deep sense in which when you're studying locations, land values are a very important metric to look at, because in some sense, everything else in the economy can move. So people can move and goods can move and capital can move, but land can't. And that means that a lot of the benefits of living in a place are going to have to get priced into the thing that can't move away, can't seek better options elsewhere. And in the limit, if everything is mobile, then all the benefits of living in a location, all the attractiveness of a location will be priced into the value of land. That's a deep insight, of course, going back to the work of David Ricardo, his other famous 1817 work. We were very grateful, very lucky for the fact that there was this value of land indicator for every county and every year in our study. And there are, I think, not totally implausible assumptions under which that's a great outcome variable to look at.
So what did you find?
Two main findings, I'd say. The first is that this market access outcome was heavily affected by the railroads. It's not obvious that would have been the case. Fogel's instinct was that it wouldn't have much affected the market access of a typical county because the canal and river network was already amazing. And he sort of said, well, most economic activity is already near these water networks. Railroads, by the way, were not actually much cheaper, if at all, than water or canal. So in a sense, think of what railroads did as just putting something canal water-like everywhere, as opposed to just where, God had put it. So the first thing is the market access did go up, you know, a little bit for all counties and a lot for some Midwestern and Plains counties. The second thing that was, you know, more important that's surprising for us is that, you know, that increase in market access was heavily capitalized into the value of land. So our estimates imply that the value of agricultural land, this is farmland, went up in the case of the U.S., went up by about 60%. A huge boon for landowners, for farmers in this time period. That translates, of course, land is not a huge share of the economy, so even in this time period, so that translates into about 3% of GDP.
In general, it's always good to kind of treat economic research with open eyes. Are there any caveats that we should really bear in mind when thinking about these results?
The first and most basic that I think a lot of people neglect is that these are just estimates, right? Estimates are just, they always come with statistical imprecision and lots of it, plausibly. So, you should sort of view that as like 3% plus or minus about 1. The second thing, of course, is that the estimates could be wrong. They could be biased. That could happen because of those a failure to deal with the two problems I mentioned earlier. Either market access was allocated to places that were whose land value was just improving anyway. And so we're just picking up that trend, and it just happens to be correlated with it. And the third thing, of course, is the second risk I mentioned, which is this spillovers risk, which is that we're not adequately dealing with that. I think the biggest risk there is that it's quite possible that something other than land, like, let's say maybe sort of labor or capital, that was highly mobile, they would not benefit at all. That is, all the benefits would be capitalized in purely into land if they were sort of mobile and like big. But a different scenario would be that the total stock of U.S. labor was roughly fixed. You know, there, of course, there's a little bit of immigration in this time period. But roughly speaking, the total stock is fixed. Then that total stock will benefit because railroads are kind of going everywhere here. So I think the most important sort of third caveat I'd offer is that the split that we offer between how much of this was enjoyed by landowners versus who are immobile or who own the land that's immobile, versus enjoyed by mobile factors like labor or maybe even capital, that split is not something we were well set up to study.
So let's talk about another of your railroad papers, which estimates the impact of infrastructure in colonial India. So in the paper before, you were really only looking at the impact on land values. So what are the impacts you explore in this case, in the India case?
India fascinated me from the very beginning because India is sort of the poster child for an economy that may have plausibly been transformed by railroads. This is very little water travel, very plausibly autarkic, closed local economies to, shut off from virtually all imports and exports with other parts of India. So India had a massive railroad expansion. They built 60,000 kilometers of lines in the period from about 1850 to about 1920. And I look in particular at 1870 to 1930. The remarkable thing about India was the availability of trade data to study how the railroads changed the trade flows within the economy directly, something that wasn't possible in the US, but also data on output, of physical units of output, of the stuff that people cared about. These are all the agricultural goods that spanned about maybe 60% of the economy at the time period, and also prices of each of those goods in each of these locations. And so kind of with price and quantity data, one can construct something a bit like GDP, and that's a pretty good metric for economic performance of a location.
So how was measuring the impact of railroads in this case different from the first one? What did you do?
The first insight, I saw this first in some work of Aristotle's, I'm sure it goes back before that, is that whenever you see what you think is an identical commodity for sale in two locations, you can be, and you think this is a reasonably competitive trading scenario, you can be pretty confident that the difference in the price of that identical commodity between those two locations could never be bigger than the cost of moving that good between the two locations. Because if the price gap was big and the trade cost was small, someone could just make a lot of money from like buying in the cheap place and selling in the expensive place. And in particular, there's a second insight, which says that sort of if you knew that arbitrage is taking place from location A to location B, like, for example, you know that the good can only be produced in location A, yet you know that it is always consumed in location B, then you know that goods have to be moving from that A to that B, which means that in that case, the price gap is no longer just an upper bound on the trade cost. It has to be exactly equal to the trade cost, because again, if it was bigger than the trade cost, that would be arbitraged away. If it was less than the trade cost, then there wouldn't be any reason to trade it. So this was the first insight, was that I was able to use the price data on some of these commodities to try to infer trade costs. The actual commodity in question that I found very interesting and fascinating was salt, which is a sort of remarkable good that, if you think about it, that can typically be produced in very few locations. There's no coincidence that the Romans paid their soldiers in units of salt. That's why we call it a salary to this day. You know, this is a very special commodity that has a long privileged tradition in economic history. And it was very, of course, it had a very mixed history in the case of colonial India. And what I studied was just how the price gaps for salt between those production locations and all other locations, the consuming locations, how that price gap fell as they got connected by railroads. And that's sort of a first stage that one can look at to sort of try to estimate how railroads reduce trade costs. The second thing was that there's the data on trade flows. So then we can look at a second thing, which is a little bit like the gravity equation we looked at earlier, which is it true, and by how much is it true, that when trade costs fall, trade flows go up? And that effect of trade costs on trade flows, some people call it the trade elasticity, is a very important magnitude that you need to know to start thinking about any trading problem. And we do this in the case of tariffs internationally nowadays. I did it in the case of railroads, in the case of British India. And the third thing is that sort of once you have those two ingredients, basically how much railroads reduce trade costs, the second ingredient being how much trade costs falling increase trade flows, you can construct something that looks a lot like the market access term I described earlier. And from then it proceeds very similarly to the US study I referred to earlier, where now we're looking at how a metric of economic performance in a location is affected or correlated with a change in that location's market access.
So did you collect any other interesting data for this India project?
I have to say, I mean, I was just overblown by the volume and the depth of data that the British colonial administration collected on the Indian economy. They were doing this, you know, in many of their colonies, but doing it far more so in British India than in any other colony. So, well, for example, one of the things that you would see them talk about a lot was famine. And when you're administering over an economy that has far too many famines, one of the things you start collecting when you to worry about that is rainfall. This is an extremely arid environment where droughts lead to famine, essentially. And so meteorologists cut their teeth off of kind of collecting data at thousands of rainfall stations throughout India every day in this time period. And so that that rainfall data was of importance to me, because the reason we have famines is that when there's drought, then the agricultural productivity falls and less food is produced. The exact same reason was of interest to me, because I was able to sort of study how, when you get that agricultural productivity reduction because of a scanty rainfall in a location in a given year, how that reduction in productivity affects that location's exports. And that's also an important parameter or magnitude that economists need to know when they study these kinds of environments.
Okay, so let's talk about then your bigger findings with this paper. What did you come across?
The quick summary is, you know, as you'd expect, these railroads reduce the cost of trading goods. That's an important sort of first stage, as I mentioned. The second thing is that the trade elasticity, as I referred to it earlier, how much trade costs falling increases trade flows, was in the same ballpark as we sort of see time and time again in international studies or intranational studies today. Typical elasticity have been in the ballpark of 5, implying that if you reduce trade costs by about 1%, you'll increase trade flows by about 5%. So these railroads had a big effect on trade costs and a much bigger effect on trade flows. So the final thing is to see how much that affects local output and local GDP, and that magnitude on average in this time in this set of economies in British India was about 18%.
So again, what are the caveats or the limitations that we should be aware of here?
They're very similar, I would say, conceptually to the ones I described earlier for the US, that there's the risk of non-random assignment, and second is the possibility of spillovers. I would say in this instance, on the non-random assignment point, British India was kind of neat because it wasn't about private investment. The private companies would often build these things, often under subsidies, but the decision about where to put the lines was always made by the government. And so I was able to sort of see these kind of countless administrative government reports about, you know, should we build this network here of type one, or should we instead build this network here of type two? And so that offered the possibility of comparing, of estimating, if you like, the effect of networks that never, that got planned but never got built.
Okay, let's move out of the 1800s to today. Are there policy implications that one might be able to draw from some of this research?
So I think about this sort of research as trying to hone in on the fundamentals of how market economies work at a very general level. That's obviously a grand ambition, but that's why I see the contemporary value of historical research like this. Of course, the exact magnitudes, like, you know, the US 1870 to 19 railroad expansion had an effect of 3% on GDP. That's not a useful policy input to any policy decision that anybody's making today. The railroad network would differ. The economy would differ. The total effect might be bigger or smaller. I wouldn't really know how to think about just extrapolating from that magnitude from the past to the present. But what I do feel more comfortable about is that a study like this helps us to understand how trading economies, interrelated trading economies, gain when investments are made in connecting them further. And that's the kind of investment that the Americans made in the late 19th century, you know, big time, massive investment in connectedness. And the same investment that British India made, the British government made in the case of colonial India. So I think that the gains from those connections are substantial. We see that in both of these studies. We see that in lots of other studies as well. And so I think that should be a reminder that, you know, that, and it shouldn't be really rocket science, that we all as human beings benefit enormously from trading with one another. And those trades occur kind of within the household, they occur within the village, they occur within the city, they occur across cities within the same country, across states, and they occur across nations. And these kinds of studies show us that those gains can be real. They deliver gains to landowners and to workers, and they raise GDP, and they reduce prices, and they reduce price gaps, and they increase trade flows, and they decrease volatility, and they decrease things like famines. These are all kind of consequences of gains from trade. And so to me, that's the most fundamental insight that historical examples like this teach us.
In general, do you think these findings about international trade are very, very applicable to stories about international trade?
Absolutely. I think we have to believe in the notion of pretty fundamental economic interactions between human beings, that the firms and consumers interact. They do so within cities, within countries, and within and across countries. And I don't see any, there's no deep reason why you should expect those interactions to be any different when they just happened across borders. A question that's often puzzled me, it still puzzles me, is sort of why does it apparently seem in sort of public debate that international trade is sort of so controversial and toxic, yet intranational trade is so privileged that we even sort of have a constitutional act to protect it? I mean, what is going on there? I mean, why do we talk about the China syndrome, but not the Texas syndrome, you know, as Northeasterners or something like that? Now, I don't know the answers to that, but I do sometimes fear that if you're a producer, it's much easier to point a finger at an international competitor than it is to point a finger at a domestic competitor. The other consumers in your economy benefit from competition, whether it's international or intranational. But I do fear that the difference might only just be one of salience in a sense. So that's an area that I'm dying to know more about. You know, is sort of what are the fundamental differences between intranational trade and international trade, both how they operate and also their consequences for things like inequality, and hence their consequences for politics and for debate.
Great. Many, many future Trade Talks episode idea there for us. Okay, that is all for Trade Talks.
Thanks to Dave Donaldson, Professor of Economics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, for joining us today.
And we should also thank the Julius Rabinowitz Center for Public Policy and Finance, the Woodrow Wilson School, for organizing the conference that has brought the three of us to the same location. As usual, if you have any feedback, comments, then do get in touch.
On Twitter, I'm @ChadBown.
And we're on @trade_talks.
That's not one, but two underscores, @trade_talks.
Because, of course, two papers about railroads is better than one.
Of course.